Australia's a very suburban country. The suburbs are where most of us live. What's the future for yours? The reason I ask is there's a really interesting conference starting in Melbourne tomorrow called Remaking Suburbia. It'll look at the impact of climate change on the suburbs and at how new ways of sustainable living may be possible. Suburban living is what the experts call resource intense. Some writers and academics even forecast that climate change will mean the end of suburbia and the collapse of a system that's so dependent on cheap energy and oil. So what are the options for the future? Professor Elizabeth Shove from the University of Lancaster in the UK thinks about this a lot. She joins me now. Welcome to Life Matters.
Hello, thank you.
Can you, I know you argue that unsustainability is sort of hardwired into suburbia. Can you explain why?
Well, there are certain things about the very idea of suburban life, I think. Things about kind of interacting with nature or lots of space for children to kind of grow up and run around. But above all, it's the relatively low density. These kinds of ideas and images of what the good suburban life entails simply require quite a lot of space.
I suppose that going with that, there's a lot of car use too in most suburbs.
There is, and in a way, that's one of the hardwired kinds of features, I would say, because not only are the houses sort of distributed, but the more, for example, children need ferrying about, that just multiplies the number of journeys. So it's not just the distribution, it's the way of life that goes on in suburbia that I think is sort of proliferating, in that case, mobility.
Part of how we think about this is tied up with our notions of childhood at this time, certainly my notions of childhood. Do we have to change our traditional understandings of low-density living and sort of wide open spaces for childhood?
Well, I think the childhood is a really interesting case. Various people have written as a fantastic book called Centuries of Childhood about the long-term making of the very notion of the child and the implications of that for the parent, the idea of, is the child a small adult or what kind of development is going on. So you have to position suburbia as a moment in that long-term trajectory of ideas about children and families, parents as well. And what we have at the present is probably not what we're going to have in the future in any case, because, childhood has never stayed still.
No. What has disappeared, I suppose, from the traditional idea of suburbia in the last, 30 or 40 years?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, there's a sort of dynamic not only to family life. Women are not necessarily at home working in the way that the suburban model assumed. There's something also, I think, about interaction with the outdoors, nature and the garden. It was part of the idea of the garden city. But actually gardens are shrinking, it seems, anyway, in some suburban developments. And so whilst the idea of sort of growing your own vegetables, at least in the UK, was absolutely sort of part of the suburban existence, that's definitely not the case now. So more suburban life seems to go on indoors rather than being this kind of indoor-outdoor hybrid, which was indeed part of the original ideal.
I have to tell you that I actually live in a suburb where people do garden and talk to their neighbours and the kids play in the street. It's a kind of throwback to what I had when I was a kid.
And why not? I mean, there are many, many varieties of suburban life. I mean, it's wrong, I think, it's useful up to a point to talk about it as one form. There are certain common themes and ideas, but, across different countries, suburbia has been built in very different ways and at different points in time.
One of the things, we were talking a moment ago, Elizabeth, about things that have kind of gone from suburbia, but there's also additions, aren't there? And in Australia in particular, air conditioning. And you'd argue that increasingly people have changing expectations of what the climate should be like indoors.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that in a way. The air conditioning makes it possible to sort of manage and standardise the weather, if you like, indoors, and to kind of replicate what people are becoming used to in offices, which is a sort of fairly standard 22 degrees C. And this is particularly ironic. I mean, I know when it gets really hot, that's another story, but sort of up to about 30 degrees. Suburbia, in fact, has been traditionally very well designed without air conditioning. It's possible to open the doors. There are often kind of verandas or outdoor spaces to inhabit. So this is definitely a resource-intensive trend. And one that also, I think, means that, what people are wearing indoors is very different. The seasons have sort of gone. So there's some really big dynamics there, I think, in terms of what counts as comfort Are you wearing woolly jumpers? Are you changing the clothing? You know, because the suburban site has been a site of kind of casual flexibility, but with this sort of standardising of managing the indoor weather, the doors get shut and things begin to change like that.
Well, and in your part of the world, of course, it's not so much air conditioning, but it is central heating. I was struck by, when I lived in the UK in kind of the mid-90s, how the central heating tends to come on in sort of towards the end of September, and it's really on at night until perhaps even, you know, the end of April.
That's right. I mean, of course, it varies. That's not the pattern for everybody. But again, it is a sort of the other side of air conditioning. There are various estimates that the kind of clothing people are wearing, at least in the UK, is changing. So there are fewer kind of, woolly jumpers and so on. And the heating has taken the place of the insulation that we used to wear around the body. So I don't know what the future will hold, but I think the Australian wool industry has got some opportunities there in the UK to reintroduce the woolly jumper.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Professor Elizabeth Shove, who's Professor of Sociology at Lancaster University, which is in the north of England. And she's an expert on I suppose, suburban futures. And it does seem as if our suburbs are going to have to change with climate change. Elizabeth, there are already efforts to make homes more energy efficient, but at the same time, there are these parallel trends like making the house bigger, and they kind of fight one another in a way.
They certainly do, and in a way, the size, I think, is increasing size is a very significant issue. We did some work on home extensions in the UK, and it was very interesting to ask people why did they need extra space. And some of it had to do with not necessarily an increasing family size. In fact, on the whole, household sizes are decreasing, but a changing idea of what family life involved. So the kitchen wasn't just a sort of back region for cooking. It had become the space for living and dining and entertaining children and all that kind of thing, for which then you kind of needed a bigger space. So extensions were often about accommodating this kind of vision of what everyday life should be like. Meanwhile, other rooms in the house, for example, a dining room, was more or less unused. So houses were kind of growing at the back whilst spaces were being abandoned in the middle. Now, there are other trends like more bathrooms being fitted in where there weren't, there was just one per house before. So in these, all of these developments add more to the total volume that's heated and cooled and managed, and that's very resource intensive too.
Well, we've been talking, I suppose, so far about various factors that are leading to greater resource intensity in our suburbs. Are there ways of thinking about them that retain certain suburban ideals but are less resource intense or perhaps more dense?
Well, there's two things. I mean, one is that people can, and a lot of suburbia is privately owned. So there's a certain amount that people can do in terms of adding insulation or all these sort of grey water systems. But that's really a very small part of the whole story. I think the bigger issue, as I've been describing, is what is the way of life? What are the resources that that way of life entails? And how is that changing over the longer run? So, yes, I think in the future we could imagine various different scenarios. The kind of idea you could keep a suburban vision, but actually, in fact, live in and enjoy and inhabit houses that are built for the smaller sizes of the families that are, that we now have. So there's certainly that possibility, kind of a denser form of suburbia, but that retains the way of life. I mean, I think caravan sites are really interesting like that. They have many features of suburbia, but on a micro scale.
But, I mean, you're not going to be able to convince hordes of people to abandon their suburban life for caravan sites, are you?
I think not, no. But the point is that, in a way, is this form really sustainable on the scale, 3, 4 and 5 bedrooms with 1, 2 or 3 people in the longer run? That's the real question.
So what specifically could happen? Are we talking about, you mentioned dining rooms aren't used, perhaps we could get rid of them. Are we looking at smaller gardens? We've already talked on this show not that long ago, actually, about the disappearing backyard in Australia.
Yeah. Well, one thing is that a lot of the existing suburban stock is with us already. So we're not talking about, or not necessarily talking about building new, but rather remaking what's already there. And there are possibilities. I mean, this is. I think it's important to think of on what time scale are we talking.
Mm-hmm.
So retrofitting and whatever can happen more or less today. But if you think of 100 years' time, something like that, then we could imagine different sorts of families, more kind of household units, the fences disappearing, workspaces moving in to kind of, as it were, partly abandoned suburban space, and actually a reconfiguration of the kind of social and economic activity that goes on in what we now think of as just residential.
We have a lot more of that now. I mean, a lot of houses that are built now have an office space or study as standard.
They do, and that's interesting. I think the sort of wireless and laptop-type developments mean that maybe the home office is the next dining room in the sense of the next space to be abandoned. But I agree. The point is that inside the walls of suburbia, it's a very dynamic situation.
I'm intrigued by one of the things you just suggested, which is getting rid of the fences.
Yeah.
Do you think people will be prepared? I mean, because good fences make good neighbours. We've had the idea of fences for a long time.
I suppose I was mean fences a little bit more metaphorically in terms of the kind of private ownership and the, I mean, in a way, it's part of the control and the freedom of suburbia is about ownership.
Mm.
But ownership of how much and on what scale and what are the relations with the neighbours. And so whilst you say the fences make good neighbours, there are other forms of social interaction. I mean, for example, sharing gardens, that would be an interesting possibility without the fence between.
So do you think that we're heading for a time when the idea that we have at the moment of suburbia, which is actually somewhat out of kilter with what many of us actually live in,
yeah,
but, you know, quite a large block, low density, mm-hmm, that will end up just being the kind of preserve of the rich who want it, and everybody else is going to have to live a bit closer together and closer to transport and things like that?
Well, will it be the rich? I mean, it might be the kind of, you know, these places are perhaps going to be incredibly undesirable. They're impossible to heat and cool and manage in a much more carbon-constrained future. They're hopelessly difficult to get to without terribly problematic forms of mobility. So whether it's the rich, I'm not sure about that at all.
It occurs to me, though, that between now and then, it's going to be hard to convince people. Lots of people like living in suburbs. And in places like Sydney's Upper North Shore, there are locals, there's quite a movement actually, fighting against the increasing building of apartments in their area, which they think is changing the character of where they live.
That's where I think it's interesting. Is it the suburban form that matters, or the ideals of suburban life that it's been so strongly associated with? Are there other ways of building that can actually, in a way, preserve these versions of, changing versions of childhood, of home and work and so on, without necessarily threatening that kind of, I mean, genuine aspiration?
Elizabeth, it's been really interesting. Thank you very much for joining us today.
OK, thanks. Bye.
That's Professor Elizabeth Shaw from the University of Lancaster. And she's here for the Remaking Suburbia Conference. It's at the Centre for Design at RMIT University. And it begins tomorrow. You'll find details on our website. Just remind you of that, actually, abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. And you can comment on anything you hear. That is the easiest thing to do. And we will have more of your comments coming up later in the show. But coming up next, the story of Katie Regan. She slept with her best friend and ended up pregnant.